From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The drug maker Moderna says its COVID-19 vaccine is nearly 95% effective, according to preliminary data published today. Welcome news that comes 1 week after similar results from Pfizer and just 1 day after more Americans were hospitalized due to coronavirus than ever before.
And even with this latest surge in new cases, healthcare workers report treating patients who deny the reality of the pandemic. Here's Jody Doring, an ER nurse in South Dakota, speaking to CNN.
It wasn't one particular patient. It's just a culmination of so many people. And their last dying words are, this can't be happening. It's not real.
Let's bring in Dr. Clay Smith, president of the South Dakota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And Dr. Smith, we just heard from that nurse who said she sees people who are dying and don't believe they even have COVID-19. We're also seeing these staggering numbers out of South Dakota today. Johns Hopkins reports 60% of those who got tested there tested positive. What is top of mind for you when you hear that number?
See, that is staggering. I think that's way beyond what most other states have seen. When I order a test, if I think somebody likely has COVID, most of those are coming back positive. And I would actually say that 60% number is even probably somewhat falsely low, in the sense that some of those tests are for things like preoperative screening, where we're not actually getting those tests based on suspicion. So when we're getting a test based on clinical suspicion, you know, those numbers are actually probably significantly higher than that.
What do you think is going on here? Why do you believe there's such a huge surge, particularly in South Dakota?
People are really reticent to wear masks. You go around the city I live in is Rapid City. You drive around Rapid City, and actually it's gotten better, but the prevalence of people that you see in masks is really quite low. It's concerning.
Well, even leadership is kind of pushing this narrative that the people of South Dakota are free to make their own choices. That's what the South Dakota governor has said. But I want to ask you about something else. Hospitals in many parts of the country are at or near capacity treating COVID-19 patients. And that doesn't always mean there aren't enough beds, but there may not be adequate staffing to care for patients. What should we understand about this challenge in rural areas?
Yeah, I think staffing is a real challenge. At the hospital that I work at primarily, we have five physicians. If two of us go out with COVID or something else, that becomes very difficult to staff our facility from a physician standpoint.
Yeah. With all that you're saying about the crisis there, what is the path forward to bring the case count down?
Frankly, we just need to get better about all of the things that, you know, that we all know that we should be doing. You know, the social distancing, mask wearing, you know, staying home from work if you're sick, those types of things. I think what we need to do is reframe what we're instructing people to do.
Reframe that. But have you had any patients that don't believe in COVID?
Yes.
And how do you handle that? How do you mitigate that? I mean, it's just astounding to hear the nurse that we heard from say she's serving patients on their dying bed who say, I don't believe I'm even dying from what you're saying I'm dying from.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I will tell you, the very first patient that I diagnosed with COVID fit that description and did end up passing away from it. And you show these folks the test results. And, you know, unfortunately, I think there's a subset of people who are just so dug into this idea that this isn't real. That being said, I don't think that that's a majority of folks in this part of the country, and I don't think that that's common, but I definitely have run into that.
Well, understanding this reality and knowing that the numbers are increasing, is a vaccine the only answer at this point?
I'd like to think not. Again, how do we frame things for people so that they can feel like they're empowered to do something about this and feel like they can be part of the solution? And I think one of the things that, you know, if you look at the R number, essentially is the number of people on average that a person infects after contracting COVID. And if you look at that number, experts have estimated that number would be about 3 if there was no interventions done. Well, even in South Dakota, we're only around 1.1 to 1.2.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can move that number to even 0.9 or 0.8, all of a sudden, the number of active cases starts to go down. I mean, I think if we can get people to think about what can I do to help move that needle, to buy into doing their part, which, you know, unfortunately, we've had a hard time doing so far.
Dr. Clay Smith is president of the South Dakota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, former President Obama has a new memoir out tomorrow. It's called A Promised Land. It's the first of two volumes. Our colleague Michelle Martin, weekend host of All Things Considered, sat down with the former president on Friday. They discussed his reaction to the election, President Trump's refusal to concede, lessons from his presidency. And Michelle Martin is here with more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, you too. And we haven't heard from the former president since Biden was declared the winner of this election. What did he have to say about Trump's refusal to concede?
Well, I certainly asked him, so let's let him tell you. Let's play it.
I don't think he'll be successful in denying reality. And you're starting to see a few Republican elected officials go ahead and say, look, Joe Biden has been elected, and we need to move on in the transition. I'm distressed that you haven't seen more Republican leadership make this clear, because the amount of time that's being lost in this transition process has real-world effects. Look, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We are in the middle of an economic crisis. We have serious national security issues.
So very low-key, as we have come to expect in the former president's presentation, but you can hear the frustration.
Yeah. Well, he lists the difficulties facing the country. The COVID-19 pandemic has never been worse. How did he address this, former President Obama? How do you address it directly?
Well, here's what I asked him, Robin. I said to him, look, if you have advice for Joe Biden, you're going to tell him directly. But you've always been a proponent of people power. What should citizens be doing right now, in your view? And this is what he said.
All of us as citizens need to work and get behind a clear plan for getting this pandemic under control. Because if we can get the pandemic under control, the economy then is in a position to start bouncing back. But beyond that, what I think all of us as citizens are going to have to do is to really start examining what can each of us do, whether it's at the local level, in our own families, to step back from the demonization of each other, the bitter partisan divides that we're seeing, and ask ourselves, what role can we play in rebuilding social trust?
Well, again, it was really fascinating, Robin, that you could sort of hear this struggle between he's always had this desire to not make it be about him, which I think some people might be surprised by. But the reality of it is that the source of his politics, the basis of his politics, is not what I'm going to do. It's what we're going to do together. And that's where he kept steering the conversation.
Right. Well, it's so interesting that he sees that the answer to getting out of the pandemic is healing the divide. You know, he connected the two. So you've read the book. Many people haven't had a chance. Tell us a little more about it.
Well, I think that it depends on what your expectation of a political memoir is. I mean, if your expectation of a political memoir is that I go from triumph to triumph and everybody else is wrong and I'm right all the time, then you will be very surprised by this, because there is a lot of vulnerability. There's a lot of self-doubt. He talks a lot, of course, as I think people know by now, he talks a lot about his childhood and kind of how he got where he got. Donald Trump does not play a major role in this volume, but he does. There are hints of what is to come. And I asked him, I said, you know, you had a really strong personal connection with people. You could see it during the campaign. People wanted to give you things. They wanted to give you their lucky totems. I said, but you also have to accept that people felt the same way about Donald Trump, maybe different people, but people nonetheless wanted to connect with him and felt connected to him. And I asked him, you know, how you feel about that. And this is what he said.
I was obviously thrilled, humbled, and moved by the connection that you described, that, you know, particularly in that first campaign, right, where people put invested so many of their dreams and hopes into getting me elected. I could not have won had it not been for that passion and spirit that people invested in me. But as I note during the book, there's a danger in thinking this is just about one person, as opposed to this is about government across the board, members of Congress and governors and state legislators and district attorneys, because we start thinking that just one person can solve all these problems, when in fact, by design, our democracy disperses power.
Well, Robin, and so there you have it. And I do want to tell you that he did talk a lot about the role that race played in his presidency and in the way he was perceived. So have no doubt about that. We did talk about it.
Michelle Martin, we'll hear more of her conversation later today on All Things Considered. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles District Attorney's Office oversees the largest jail system and prosecutor's office in the United States, and it now has a new boss, George Gascon. Gascon, a Democrat, unseated incumbent Jackie Lacey in this month's election, and progressives are calling his win a victory for criminal justice reform. But Gascon received little to no support from the law enforcement establishment during his campaign, and he'll face challenges implementing his agenda. George Gascon joins us now for more. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you so much.
You campaigned on a number of issues, one being an agenda of not pursuing the death penalty and possibly reopening investigations into fatal police shootings. What's first on your agenda when you actually officially take office on December 7th?
Well, I mean, the issue of death penalty obviously is one that we're moving to address immediately, because there are ongoing death penalty prosecutions in the county. In fact, I've gotten lawyers calling me that they're heading into the sentencing portion of a death penalty case even before I get sworn in. So that is something that I want to address, because it's easier to put a stop to some of those cases than to unwind them down the road. The other thing that is also something that I'm going to do immediately is I committed and will stop prosecuting children as adults. We have a lot of ongoing cases involving kids as young as 14 years of age that are being prosecuted as adults. We have committed to looking at some police officer involved shootings. So there's a lot of things that are going to be happening very early on, and then other things are going to take more time.
You received tremendous support from criminal justice reformers. Actually, your first public meeting and appearance since winning, you actually met with Black Lives Matter organizers and the families of people shot by police. I mentioned you don't have much support from law enforcement in this state, and many are saying this meeting sets the tone for your tenure. Do you agree with that, and how do you hope to redefine LA's DA office?
Yeah, and look, I mean, there is no question that police unions pour, and prison guards union, by the way, they pour millions of dollars in support of my opponent. But, the reality is that the majority of the leadership in law enforcement are dedicated men and women that want to do the right things. And the elections are over. The elections are over in more ways than one. You know, I tell people that this was a referendum on reform. I think the reality is that the public in the state, as well as in the county, has spoken very clearly about two things. A, we don't want to go back to the past. And B, we actually want to move forward into a different reality. And I think that's a mandate that law enforcement has to listen to it loud and clear. And if they don't, then that's going to have consequences for their own, for their own ability to continue to do their work. And I think that most of the leadership in law enforcement recognizes that this is a new day, and that we have to move forward and work together. And certainly I'm here to roll up my sleeves and work with all the stakeholders.
But to that point, I mean, on the flip side of it, though, how do you keep the support of those progressives who have supported you while also working with law enforcement?
Well, because, look, I mean, I think the reality is that we all have to work together, right? This cannot be done in a vacuum, right? You cannot have a one-sided relationship. You have to acknowledge that there's going to be different ways to look at a problem. One of the things that I tell people all the time, and I did that during my entire campaign, I will never compromise on principle, but I will hear you out and we will try to work on process where we can. So, for instance, that's when I said, look, I mean, the death penalty, It's a non-negotiable. Prosecuting children as adults is non-negotiable. Police accountability is going to be non-negotiable. But there are many other ways that we're going to work and find, you know, mutual ground to work together. And we have to, and we should. So it's not an all or nothing game. It's how do people work together? Because at the end of the day, and listen, this is something that I have known my entire life. I grew up in a very poor neighborhood. Quite frankly, the police were not our friends where I grew up. But I knew, you know, including my parents, that they didn't want to have their homes broken into, just like they didn't want to have the kid next door going to prison forever, right? So it's understanding that there has to be a more nuanced approach to our work and recognizing that community safety is a collective responsibility. And that collective responsibility includes the definition of what community safety looks like. It cannot be one that is simply engineered by the police and prosecutors or police unions. It needs to be engineered by all of us together. But, you know, come to a conclusion that everybody wants to live in harmony, and they want to live, you know, have the quiet enjoyment of their community. They don't want to be harassed by the police, but they don't want to be victimized either.
Your victory is seen as part of a progressive shift, not only for Los Angeles, but nationally, where there's really been this push in places like Philadelphia and Texas to end mass incarceration. I mean, what changes do you want to see in the U.S. criminal justice reform nationwide? And where does California sit in kind of turning the tide that you and many others who are in these positions of power want to see?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, I think at the, you know, sort of the very high level, we need to address systemic racism. You know, we need to come to grips with the fact that, you know, poor people, especially black and brown people, get treated very differently by the criminal justice system, and differently, not in a good way, but in a really bad way. And that has to be acknowledged. And then, you know, we became the most carceral society in the world in the last 40 years. We had an option to go in a different direction, and we didn't. You know, we doubled down on incarceration, militarization of policing, more jails, more prisons, more prosecutors. We have destroyed entire communities. We've destroyed generations of people within communities. And this is a day of reckoning now. How do we start, you know, repairing the harm that we have caused? And some of it, by the way, is irreparable. But where do we say, okay, we're going to break ties with that, and we're going to move into a more humane, more thoughtful future. And my goal is certainly, in my little corner of the world here in LA County, is to acknowledge the harm, acknowledge that it exists, and then bring people to the table and make them partners, equal partners.
That's George Gascon, Los Angeles County's new elected district attorney. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonny. I really appreciate it.
Well, tonight, four astronauts are expected to arrive at the International Space Station, becoming the first ever crew to get there on a mission by a private company. SpaceX launched the astronauts from the Kennedy Space Center last night. And joining us now for more on what this means for the future of space travel is Brendan Byrne, reporter for WMFE in Orlando, Florida. And Brendan, you were actually at the launch last night. What was it like?
Oh, it was awesome. There is nothing quite like a night launch, and especially when there's astronauts on top. It was brilliant.
Yeah. We mentioned this flight is a milestone for SpaceX's partnership with NASA, which began in 2006. Remind us about the path to this historic event. How did a private company actually come to launch this crew?
Well, this program started all the way back in like 2006, and basically NASA needed to fill a void that was left by the space shuttle program as it was retiring in 2011. So NASA asked the commercial spaceflight community for rides to the station and ended up picking SpaceX and Boeing. And now part of the contract that they came up with required the companies prove these vehicles, SpaceX's Crew Dragon and Boeing's Starliner, were safe. So they first started flying an uncrewed mission, followed by a crewed mission. Now, SpaceX, you might recall, earlier this year had a successful crewed mission with astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley back in May. That laid the groundwork for the mission yesterday. Boeing is still working to certify its vehicle, but we are moving in that direction.
Okay, these astronauts who are on board, who are they?
So there's three NASA astronauts and one Japanese astronaut. So from the U.S., there's Mike Hopkins and Shannon Walker. These are both veteran space flyers. And there's also Victor Glover. This is his first space mission, and he'll become the first black crew member on an extended stay on the International Space Station. On the Japanese space agency, JAXA sent astronaut Soichi Noguchi. Now, these four will join three already on board the station. That will be seven on the ISS. So it's actually so packed, NASA ran out of bedrooms. So Mike will have to live in the Crew Dragon as it's docked to the station.
Oh, wow. Okay, I want to ask you about something else. NASA's Artemis program plans to land the first woman and the next man on the moon in 2024. How big of a role could we expect SpaceX to have in this? And where does the SpaceX and NASA program go from here?
That's right. Well, NASA is really leveraging these commercial partners to get humans to the moon. And SpaceX is one of the companies that bid to design the next moon lander. It's also going to be one of the companies that will ship supplies to a moon base space station ahead of astronaut missions. And NASA and SpaceX will continue their partnership, sending more astronauts next year. And they continue to send supplies to the International Space Station under that commercial partnership.
Wow. Okay, so let's go there. What's next after the moon?
Well, NASA's always had Mars as its long-term goal, with the plan to head to the moon first, you know, make our mistakes closer to home, and then take what we learned on the moon and then go on to Mars. So hopefully missions to Mars will soon follow.
Fascinating. That's Brendan Byrne, reporter for WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Brendan, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Throughout the country, state and local health officials are issuing new restrictions on businesses to help tamp down on the pandemic's latest surge. As we know, many businesses are still trying to keep their heads above water and wondering whether Congress will pass another relief package before the end of the year. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, a CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill.
Good morning.
Well, last week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell indicated that what many feel is obvious, the need for a new relief package after shutting down talks before the election. Why does he appear to be reversing course now?
Well, he was always, I think, talking about a stimulus bill. It's just that right before the election, he came out and said, you know, oh, we're not going to do a bill that's as big. And so there's a big difference between what the administration, that via the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, they were talking about, say, about a $1.8 trillion deal. Meanwhile, McConnell was really talking about a $500 billion deal. Now it looks like many of these legislators are realizing that as the economy does slow down through the end of the year with a spiking virus, they are going to have to do something. Whether that gets done in the lame duck session or not is unclear.
I mean, so it sounds like the dollar amount is a big point of contention. But what are some of the other things that Democrats and Republicans are divided over?
Well, it's interesting because early on, as the economy started to get some, basically make some headway and gain some ground, some of the Republicans really said, well, maybe we don't need a stimulus at all. But obviously, given these new shutdowns that are occurring all over the country in different places, we are seeing the economy slow here in the fourth quarter. One of the big contentions is really, what does this stimulus look like? Is it a series of checks, like we had those $1,200 checks to families, individuals that made less than $75,000 or $150,000 if you're married? Is it the enhancement of unemployment benefits? That seems to be one of those really tough issues where Republicans say we don't need to do $600 a week extra. We need to do $300 or $400. The Democrats really want to hold to $600. You know, at this point, I'm sure many people who have lost that benefit just say, give me something. And then finally, I think a really big issue is around the states. Yeah. And many states operating under this depth of budget crises need help from the federal government, and a lot of lawmakers don't think that the states and the localities need as much as the Democrats believe they need.
Well, President-elect Joe Biden is also urging Congress to act now before he actually takes office in January. The other option is to wait and push for a more ambitious bill once he's in office, but that's a gamble. What is Biden's strategy to help the economy with the minute I have with you?
Well, I think that it's starting to get the sense that from the incoming administration that they really want to do something. And the fear that they have is that when Obama took over during the financial crisis, the stimulus package that was passed really was under that $1 trillion threshold, $800 billion or so. And there are a lot of economists who said that was just too small. So I think the Biden administration is trying to weigh getting something done and giving relief as quickly as possible with, we probably don't get another chance to go back to the well, so let's make sure we get something passed. And that's what they're trying to balance right now.
Mm-hmm. That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you.
Great to be with you.
There was a chilling moment in this past weekend's Trump supporter march in Washington. Fox News was doing live coverage when the screen was filled with a sign that read, "Coming for Blacks and Indians first. Welcome to the New World Order." It was up for several seconds before the network cut away, the anchor acknowledging, "We just saw a disturbing sign." Well, there were also armed white supremacist militias in attendance. Now, people on the left working to bridge the divide between what appears to be two Americas are not suggesting reaching out to them. But what about millions of other Americans who voted for Donald Trump? A couple years ago, we heard about liberals from Western Massachusetts who reached out through a friend to conservatives in Kentucky in 2016. Here was the initial response in Kentucky.
Well, I was a little apprehensive. Afraid it was another Save the Dumb Hillbillies project. We've really been exploited many times by the media.
They overcame their fears. The group is now called Hands Across the Hills. Let's bring back Paula Green, a conflict resolution expert from Leverett, Massachusetts. Paula, welcome back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Good to speak with you. And Gwen Johnson joins us from Whitesburg, Kentucky. She's the daughter of a strip miner. Gwen, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
This was not easy in 2016. You talked about some of your fellow Kentuckians when you made a trip up to Western Mass. Like, I think you packed all your own food because you weren't sure what people ate.
Yeah, well, we were really apprehensive, but we felt like it was a conversation that needed to be had.
Yeah. And Paula, how did some of your liberal friends from Western Massachusetts view these people from a coal mining community who had voted for Donald Trump?
Well, this project was created by a whole community of us, and we were also anxious, didn't know who our guests would actually turn out to be. But we were also very eager to begin this process.
Mm-hmm. You came to this understanding of each other, and the key on one side had to do with the Holocaust, the other, the dangerous life of miners. Let's listen to what you told us in 2018, starting with Gwen in Kentucky.
Well, I've always been aware of the Holocaust, but I could really sympathize when they began to talk about the family experiences around that. It was rich to be among them. It was rich.
Two things came for us. One is the tremendous pride that people had in mining. World War II, the miners were heroes. They couldn't even be drafted because they had to stay home and keep mining coal for the war effort. And the other thing we heard was a tremendous danger and death. People talk about husbands, fathers, brothers, sons dying in the mines, either from black lung or from boulders that fall. So I think the compassion built up on both sides.
Paula, did it hold up?
I would say that it held up with us well. First of all, I thought long and hard about what the first dialogue ought to be about because in the beginning I wanted to try to build common ground and create safety. And so I settled on family stories because we all have family stories. As it turned out, two of the women in our group had Holocaust histories. And I think for our Kentucky colleagues, that was a moment of revelation and empathy building. And then when they talked about coal mining, that same was true for us. And I would say that our relationships have held up very well. We've met together three times over the 4 years, and we've built something very solid.
just the respect that was shown to try to understand, not to stereotype. Folks wanted to hear our stories, and we wanted to hear theirs. What has happened is that these friendships have grown. And so when the winner was declared, I made a couple of calls to Leverett to say congratulations.
You mean the winner, Joe Biden, in this recent election? Was that with a lump in your throat? I mean, how did you feel about Donald Trump losing?
We're apprehensive. People are downcast and fearful, but we are Americans. And when that person wins the election, then they are our president. He will be my president. But in the past, we have felt retaliation.
Are you saying you feel retaliation from the new administration that comes in, maybe federal funding or retaliation from average Americans? What do you feel?
Retaliation from the administration.
Geez, I mean, you know, people would say, wow, you got Mitch McConnell, who seems to, you know, be in a very powerful position. But that's how you feel. Paula, how have you guys weathered this notion that she's profoundly disappointed in the election? I'm presuming you're not. You know, how do you help yourself through that?
Those relationships are not about our politics. They're about our personhoods. And on that level, I think we've stayed pretty connected. And we know that some of us vote differently. And we were never in the business of trying to convert or convince or cajole the other to change their minds.
What is the ingredient that has kept you guys together? Gwen said she felt respect. But a lot of people hearing that are going to say, how do I demonstrate that when I don't respect somebody on the other side, you know, of the political spectrum? So what does that look like?
For us, respect is separated from political views. Disrespecting others is damaging. It's insulting. I don't disrespect them. That's really not okay.
So, Gwen, you said, you know, it was respect. What does that feel like to you? What does respect look and feel like?
It looks and feels like active listening, someone who genuinely is trying to understand, who is genuinely interested in what you have to say. Mm.
Paula, you're a professional. Can you give the rest of us some tips? How do you do that? I mean, I know there are techniques like using the I word instead of the you word, but give us some of the building blocks.
Well, I've learned the value of having lots of time. We had hours of dialogue every day. We also had music, dance, drama, endless potluck meals, walks. Not all of us are skilled verbally. Some of us enter relationships through different doors, so we had many of them. And we included our larger community because we wanted more people to have the impact of meeting others who they were stereotyping and to be able to shift out of those stereotypes.
So Gwen, talk about some of the ground rules. What are you not encouraged to do?
Crosstalk when someone else is talking is one thing. So if I'm the one speaking, everyone just respectfully listens. And it sets up an environment where we come to know these personal stories. And there was someone from Leverett who made the comment that before they met us, that we were cardboard cutout figures. And we became real. Hmm.
Did it change the way you watched the news over the past year? Did you find yourself seeing people as opposed to, as you said, cardboard cutouts?
Yes. I attended a peaceful protest just to stand in solidarity with those who have been accosted wrongly. Breonna Taylor and George Floyd's situations and murders. So it just broadened our view. I always say that once the mind is stretched beyond where it was, it can't go back to the same shape. And mm-hmm. So ours have been stretched by this collaboration with our friends in Leverett. And mm-hmm. I would venture to say that theirs have been stretched as well.
Yeah. But Paul, I have to ask you, how do people do this? We, you know, not everyone can have a friend in Kentucky who can arrange, you know, several days of meeting.
Well, I think it could be approached within our own communities through church groups, civic organizations, schools, neighborhoods. many of us have people who voted differently inside our own families, and learning how to speak to them is another outcome that's possible. So we don't all have the very good fortune of being able to meet people who live 1,000 miles away, but we can meet people who live a mile away and who think differently and vote differently. We developed our guidelines together. We worked hard on them for a long time. We wrote them down, put them on big flip chart paper, and kept them in the room so we could remind ourselves if we ever slipped, and they helped everybody feel safe.
One of the things that helped us to feel safe was we put in an ounce. And so if we felt wounded by something that was said, we just said ounce.
You put in an ounce. Just, you give us hope. That's Massachusetts resident Paula Green and Kentucky's Gwen Johnson, part of a group called Hands Across Hills, formed in 2016 to bridge the divide, and a conversation, as we hear, that's continued. Paula, Gwen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Since the beginning of the pandemic, doctors and parents have been especially worried about one group of kids, those with compromised immune systems. Conventional medical wisdom dictates that immunocompromised children are especially vulnerable, but research suggests that may not be true for the coronavirus. Liz Tong of WHYY's The Pulse has more.
Having to quarantine and take lots of precautions is nothing new for Karen Marsh and her 18-year-old daughter, Victoria, who live in Middletown, Delaware.
We've always kind of done what everybody is doing recently. So for the past 5.5 years, we've been conscious of who we're around and how they might be sick. And Victoria's had face masks.
That's Karen. And the reason their families had to be so careful is because 5.5 years ago, when Victoria was 13, she was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, an aggressive bone cancer that's tough to treat and even tougher in Victoria's case because she has Down syndrome, which affects the way her body metabolizes drugs. One important treatment they've relied on is chemotherapy. It's helped keep Victoria alive. But according to Karen, there's a trade-off.
It just wipes out your immune system. She's really susceptible to getting all types of viruses. She just doesn't have the antibodies in her system to fight anything.
Even a common cold can be deadly for people with compromised immune systems. So a few months ago, when Victoria came down with a fever one night, her doctors told her to come into the hospital. There, they tested her for COVID, and the results came back positive.
So in my head, my worst case scenario is what you hear about on TV, where everybody's on a ventilator.
Karen watched Victoria like a hawk, waiting for all the dreaded symptoms she'd heard about on the news to appear. But except for a slight cough, none of them ever did.
Never felt crappy, never got sick, never was nauseous, never had aches and pains.
After a few days, Victoria was back to normal, which to Karen felt like a miracle. How could it be that people with regular immune systems were getting so sick, even dying from COVID, while someone like Victoria had emerged basically unscathed?
Because in reality, when you think about it, the immunocompromised children should be at greater risk.
But according to Saul Wasuliman, an infectious disease physician, that's not what's happening.
They are not getting sicker, which has been a really fascinating discovery that none of us really expected.
Suleiman works at Nemours, the same hospital where Victoria was treated. And as part of her job, she sees a lot of immunocompromised kids. Kids like Victoria, who are getting chemo. Kids with genetic immune deficiencies, or HIV. In other words, kids who are often very sick and very vulnerable. Which is why, as the first cases of COVID were being reported in the U.S., children's hospitals across the country tightened up their safety guidelines.
We were very worried that the immune-suppressed patients, solid organ transplant patients, bone marrow transplant patients, that they were going to be the most severely affected because we know their immune systems are not at a normal, healthy place.
They even put a hold on non-emergency organ transplants. But as the weeks went by, Suleiman says, they realized the immunocompromised kids were actually doing pretty well, with mild symptoms and low rates of infection.
And that's across solid organ transplant, bone marrow transplant, you know, primary immune deficiencies, patients with cancer getting chemotherapy. So it's not just one specific group and their immune defect. It's sort of across the board.
It didn't seem possible. But as it turned out, researchers across the world were finding the same thing.
The severity of disease doesn't seem to be associated significantly with immunocompromise in a way that you would expect.
That's Philip Zachariah. He's a pediatric infectious diseases physician at Columbia University Medical Center and hospital epidemiologist at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Over the past few months, Zachariah has not only cared for COVID patients, both kids and adults, he's co-authored a study designed to figure out how COVID-19 behaves and which kids were most likely to get sick. Months and several thousand patients later, scientists have started getting a grasp on what the people who are getting really sick seem to share.
One of the common threads underlying severe COVID-19 seems to be some dysregulation of your immune system. And particularly in adults, on day 5 to 7, there appears to be this over-exuberant immune response, which seems to lead to a lot of the damage that is happening.
You might have heard of cytokine storms, a phenomenon where the immune system overreacts and releases so many cytokines, a kind of protein, that they start attacking the body. This, again, is Salwa Suleiman.
In some infections, the immune system goes so overboard that it then causes more problems, which we have absolutely seen with COVID-19 infection and this intense amount of inflammation that we see.
Scientists think this might just be the key to why immunocompromised kids are doing better than expected. It's not just because they're kids. It might actually have something to do with the fact that their immune systems are weakened. You might have heard of multi-system inflammatory syndrome. It's basically the kid version of cytokine storms. And what's most interesting about it is who's getting it. Namely, kids with totally normal immune systems. As for immunocompromised kids, so far they've been relatively safe. Of course, that doesn't mean families or hospitals should cut any safety measures. Scientists say it's still too early to know for sure what's happening. But at the very least, it's good news for kids like Victoria and parents like Karen. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Tung.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.